Okay. So, this is exciting actually to be able to share about Master, but let's make it a little more of a sharing, and I'll tell you why. There's nothing that I could say tonight that we don't all already know. We've heard all the stories. We know exactly what Master's mission was. Nothing's going to be brand new. But if we can create a way for his vibration to be present with us, for us to be aware of his vibration, I should say, so that we can really have an experience, like when he said to Swamiji about the AY, did you like it? Swamiji said, I loved it. He said, that's because my vibration is in it. And long before Swamiji had any idea about what vibration meant, even the word, he knew intuitively when Master said that. And I think we can all feel that. A part of the discussion that we're having right now about our community, and when you really have to try and think and articulate, why does a place matter? You know, really? Because the argument could be, why do we need community? Community's in your heart. You know, we can go up to, I went up to Portland 2 weeks ago. I felt completely at home, completely, like I was in Ananda. It's not really my community in a way, in terms of that physical space. But when I think about our community, one of the ways that I've been able to articulate its importance is that we have spent 30 years calling on Master in that place, so that when we walk outside, whether we're conscious of it or not, his vibration is in the ether. You know, when he said these words, my vibration's going into the ether right now. Young people will go north, south, east, west, creating communities of high thinking and simple living. He meant what he was saying to us. He meant, I'm putting my vibration in the ether for that to happen. So when we come together, whether it's for a class like this tonight, or it's sitting in our community, and as I said, I've been thinking a lot about it because I wanted to make a case for why a physical community matters. Of course, that's what Master asked us to do, so that's why it matters. That's what Swami Kriyananda spent his whole life doing, was creating community, so it matters. But we have been spiritualizing and making sacred that land that we live on by sitting in front of each of those shrines, by sitting there with Master, praying. Many times during the day you walk by that shrine, somebody's out there energizing in front of Master by 5:30 in the morning, praying, sitting there at lunch, meditating. I mean, whatever people do, really to tune into and call upon his vibration. It's a great gift that we have. And it's important for us to remember on a night like tonight that if we open to that, you know, first I thought, should we just get together and meditate for an hour and a half? Not joking, but play one of his talks, meditate. Play him chanting, meditate. Because what did he want all of his disciples to do more than anything was just tune into his vibration. So it won't be in the words tonight, but it will be more in what we can bring to as many aspects of him as we speak about. So when I sat down to think about this today, I decided that what I would do is pull that chapter out of his biography that Swami Kriyananda wrote. It's on his salient characteristics. Swamiji lists 32 of them. We'll go through some of them. And then for each of them, I just would sit and meditate and go to different places, the AY, the new path, conversations, and find stories that show how he was that quality that Swamiji was writing about in him. And then we could each take a moment and reflect. There are 32 of them. We won't go through 32. But we'll go through whatever we go through. And then we can each reflect on how can we become that quality more clearly? How can we be manifesting that exact quality in our lives? You know, this is silly in a way, but I reread a lot of the early chapters in a lot of the books about the very early days of Master's life and his coming here. That's not the story that I want to tell. But when you read 4 or 5 versions of that, and you keep reading from January 5th, 1887, and you just read those early stories and you plug into how he came in, the extraordinary willpower that he had. I mean, the story of when he was 2 years old and he insisted on having a piece of candy in the middle of the night. And has everybody read the story? Do you know the story? No. Okay. So he, hello. Wow, what a treat. Hi, dear. I'm very happy to have you all here. This is so interesting because just this morning I wrote Eloisa a note and I said to her, you know, I've had no time with you. I haven't seen you in so long. And I was writing to her a little bit about it and how often I think about her. And she wrote me back this beautiful note. And then here you are. Now I'm going to back up so that I can see it. I was trying to get closer to my people here. Whoops. Anyway, thanks, Esmeralda. Thank you, dear. Mm-hmm. Anyway, just reading it over and over and realizing, and again, don't let any of this sound silly because, of course, we all know this, but you sit and you read the opening chapters of the AY or the chapter on the path where Swamiji talks about Master's history or the part in the biography or pieces in conversation where he's talking about his early life. And you start thinking, my God, look at what happened in the world. An avatar was born. And very clearly the distinction gets made that many saints are born. There are a lot of saints, and we know them. And interestingly, I was surprised at the number of people, as I was reading, that Swamiji referred to as saints, a couple of whom I would have thought were avatars. But they're not referred to that way. So saints come into the world to help individuals and to do a work that's usually very focused. Avatars come in when the world itself needs to be kind of rearranged. You know, it's like it says in the Gita, whenever virtue declines and vice dominates, I'll take human form again. When the world is really in trouble, I'll take human form and I'll come in as one being. Could somebody close that drape? Sorry, thank you. As one being who's going to make an impact throughout the universe as we know it, and probably throughout the universe that we don't know. I mean, really. But just to realize the difference that these beings, certain beings, come in, and they come in, it's so dear, they come in, they're born through a mother. I mean, they come in like we come in, and they then need to go through so much of the human experience so that we can see and learn and even begin to imagine, which is what we're going to do tonight. I was just saying we're going to look at the chapter from the biography of the salient characteristics that Swamiji wrote about in the biography that he wrote about Master. I went through that today, and I just found stories from a lot of our different books that many of us have read. So it's fun. They're stories. We'll read them. We'll talk about them a little bit and then say, how can we bring these qualities into our life? Because they make us think, we can do that. Of course we can do that. What did Master do when five bullies surrounded him and they were going to fight with him. You know, what did he do when it was raining too hard that he couldn't take a trip? So many things that we run into. They create these scenarios that look like everyday life. They are everyday life. And then we get to see, how do I take my next step in those ways? And almost all of you have heard me say this, but this is extraordinarily good karma that we have to come in right on the heels of an avatar with a teacher who was a direct disciple who becomes an interpreter for us. You know, if we were just left to try and sort out what Christ meant about everything on our own, how many of us could do that? We've all read the Bible. How many of us could get with the kind of clarity that we have? Many people have come into this church who are Christians who have said to me, I never understood a word Christ said until I came here to Ananda. Well, that's Swami Kriyananda who did that for us. That's exactly what he did. He didn't do as he said to us. You all think you would love to be there with Master, but that was hard. He said, I explain everything to you in detail. And what a gift it is. So we had Master who came as this avatar who just died in 1952. Am I the only one who was already born? Maybe by 1952. But you guys all came in soon after that. Yeah, I always think, wow, I shared this country for 5 years with him. Isn't that amazing? That thrills me. And my birthday is September 11th, and Swamiji was traveling to see Master on those days. I've always thought that was great good karma, actually. But it's great good karma for all of us that we had Swamiji, and then we had all of these teachers who lived with Swamiji. So we can really look at these teachings that were brought by an avatar. Virtue declined, vice predominated, Master came. And when you get to look back at the scenario of Lahiri going up to Babaji, of Babaji saying, you take this back, this is soon going to be disseminated in the West. How odd that must have been for Lahiri to hear. But he told Sri Yukteswar, we're going to bring you the disciple who will take these great teachings to the West. I mean, for lifetimes, of course, but for centuries that we can follow right now. We can read about it. There's pictures of it. I mean, it's very real to us that we could see how, that we could see the whole layout of it. We see the map. It was time. We were heading into Dwapara. I find it very hard to believe that it's actually getting lighter yet, but we know it is. We know how the story ends. We know we all wind up at the top of at the yugas again, you know, living in pure states of bliss all the time. So there's not going to be any surprise there. And we're part of that great, extraordinary wave that's making that happen. And that's not hyperbole. Every single one of us, just because we're here tonight and we're talking about Master, and this is what he came to do. He was going to bring Kriya Yoga to the West in early Dwapara Yuga, age of energy, literally to show the world it's all energy. It can all be transformed. Nothing's fixed. It's not what you see. It's not what you think. You don't need to be even who you are right now. All you need to do is grasp these teachings, meditate a little bit, and you can be transformed. And he came all the way over here just to tell us that. And Swami Kriyananda heard it, knew it, and has shared it with us his entire life. So being in this room, even speaking of Master, is extraordinarily good karma. And I was saying at the very beginning, and I'll repeat, what we want to do tonight is plug much more into his vibration than to get stuck in even any one of the characteristics or the stories about it. So I'm going to play for us him, first of all, reading, actually it's one of his poems, God, Christ, Guru. It's just about 2 minutes long. Let's see if we can all hear it. And if there's, well, you know, Master's voice, of course we'll all hear it. When we were down in Los Angeles on one of the pilgrimages, and we were at the Hermitage. Tell me if anybody in the room was there with me on this trip. When one of the monks, the SRF monks, we were at the St. Francis Circle. Were you there? He says he's said this poem every morning of his life since he met Master. And it was very sweet because in an environment where we weren't always welcome, he said, let's say this poem together. He said, I'm sure you all know it. Let's say it together. It was very dear, wasn't it? Yeah, I just was remembering that. I had forgotten that. That was a beautiful. You know, listening to that poem, I was just thinking to myself when he was reading it, he wrote that. That came through him. We listen to it all the time, but he writes these extraordinary things that he knows he's able to put them out. And listening to him say that is very different than listening to somebody sing it. Because when somebody's singing it, you're so caught up in the beauty of the music. You know, Sai Ganesh and a couple of others just sing this so beautiful. But it's very different. For me, it was really powerful just to listen to that. And I was thinking to myself, why don't I do that every day? Like that, now that I have it right on my desktop. I think I will. this is what Master wrote that I was saying. He said, yet the role of avatars is also to raise humanity as a whole to a higher level of consciousness. That's very different, again, than a saint working, many saints, one by one with people, which is, of course, great work. But you realize the enormity of his mission. I mean, he was sent on a mission. You remember he had a vision one night of thousands of American faces, thousands in a vision. And the next day, Sri Yukteswar said to him, now is the time. He knew it, too. But it was, now's the time to start this mission. He was just called here. Every time I think about it, he was in his 20s. He had never spoken a word of English. Just gets on a boat by himself. It's pretty powerful. Yeah, okay. And then Swamiji goes on to say in the path how from even the times when he was such a very young boy, he would have all of these visions of mountaintops, which was Mount Washington, of cliffs over oceans, which of course became Encinitas. So it's just thrilling to think that he was really experiencing all of this in every moment. I mean, when we try and impossibly wrap our minds around the fact that time is a delusion, that time just really doesn't exist, that he was already here long before he was here. He saw it, he knew it, knew exactly where he was going. You know that wonderful story of Mount Washington? As soon as he drove by Mount Washington, he said, that's it. He said, stop and let me go and look at the property. And the monk who was with him said, you can't walk in there, it's private property. And he just, you know, stormed off with his orange robes behind him, literally. He called all of his people up there to do a service before he even bid on the place. He just walked into private property and claimed it energetically. I mean, it's just, you know, even that, it's such a beautiful story and such a beautiful thing to say. How do we go about something when we know it's true or we want it? What kind of energy do we bring to it? You know? Today, I met a woman when I worked at Kaiser this morning. She was 25, and she came to me because she works with liquid nitrogen. She works in tanks at Stanford, and she was terribly concerned that she had burned. She's using cryo gloves, but she said she had to be in it. You know, it's so cold that it freezes instantly. I mean, we actually use it to burn things off of skin. So you can really get burned badly by it. Anyway, she came in freaked and about these two fingers that were bothering her. And anyway, I examined her, and she actually had burned her fingers a little bit, but she was fine. I said to her, look, your hand's nice and warm, your fingers are warm, you have good blood supply. I showed her how you can see if blood keeps coming into your fingers. And I really could walk her through it. But then I said to her, I said, you know, I get the feeling something else is bothering you, because she was just looked so scared and so timid, and she just burst out into tears. It was just one of those moments, and she started telling me that she's in this impossible moment in her life. I mean, the story in a way doesn't matter, and in a way can matter. Hey, hi, what are you doing here? You're supposed to still be at the village, I thought. Okay, very nice to see you. Anyway, she was telling me this story, and she burst out in tears, and she starts telling me, but she's very meek. She was very little, in a way. And, you know, the story was hard to follow. It's an urgent care clinic, and I'm supposed to be looking at her fingers, but how much she's always loved medicine, but she had these terrible scores on her MCATs, which are these entrance exams that you have to take to go into medicine. And I asked her what her GPA was in college, and she said She had a 2.7. Everybody knows that's not great. You know, most people who are applying to medical schools have 4.0s. Anyway, I just looked at her for a while. It's just coming back to me because I'm reading this. You know, that you, I just told that story about what happened when he saw and wanted Mount Washington. That was it. Before he owned it, before anybody knew he was going to own it, he calls everybody up there. He just marches right onto the property. He claims it with all of his power, with all of his, the vibration that he has, the energy that he has. There's extraordinary lessons in there for us. I swear, I hadn't done any of this till I got home from Kaiser. You all know, I was up in Sacramento all day yesterday. I'm just working on this today. But I looked at her this morning, and I said to her, you know, I'm going to tell you something. Then I'm going to give you my email, because I don't really work here very much. So you can call me, and I won't charge you. You come and talk to me if you need to talk to me. This really happened, actually. It's pretty much blowing my mind as I'm relating the story. And I said, I want you to know we can't spend a lot of time. But I said to her, you know, you're sitting here, and you're afraid, and you're telling me this might not happen, and that might not happen, and maybe you'll decide something would happen, but then maybe everything will change. And I said to her, of course that's true. You're absolutely right. You can make up your mind. Everything could change. Everything can fall through. It probably will happen to you about 1,000 times in life, if not more. So what? I said to her, sit up straight. Decide you're going to go to medical school. You have a 490 on MCATs and a 2.7. That's not what's going to get you into medical school. What will get you into medical school is if you sit down and you write a letter and you say to every dean in any medical school you think you want to go to, look, my numbers aren't good. You know that and I know that. Let's not talk numbers. I really want to be a doctor. I've known since I was a little girl. I am meant to be a doctor. I will work hard. I will become a great doctor. And she's there like this. I mean, it was like pumping air into a blow-up doll. She was going like somebody was telling her something, of course, that she had never heard. I don't know about any of you. I wouldn't have known it if I didn't happen to be born when I was born, if I didn't happen to find Ananda, Swami Kriyananda, who knew Master, during the age of energy, everything we were just talking about. So I could say to her, you have the possibility to create your own reality. I can't guarantee you you'll get in. What I can guarantee you is you will not get in with the attitude that you walked in here with. So I said to her, now, your fingers are fine. Leave. Write to me if you want to talk to me. She got more than she bargained for in an urgent care. I swear to you, that's exactly how it went. But you know what? It was the truth. When I think back, it was exactly right. It was probably, unbeknownst to me, already getting ready to talk about Master tonight. Because I know for sure that she could get into medical school if she does it right. I mean, if she just says to every dean, you want me here. You absolutely want me here. I mean, we all know I got in without a bachelor's degree. Miracles happen. But you have to be open for them and ready for them. You have to do what Master did when he walked into Mount Washington. But you have to be real about it and make decisions and be strong about it. And in that way, I mean, just every moment of their life becomes a great lesson for us. So, Swamiji just is presenting him in the path. I was telling some people early on that I read about five chapters of the beginning of Master's life today, reading the same story over and over. But it's so beautiful. Swamiji said he had these ecstatic meditations when he was young. And he talks about how everybody, all the older people, I mean, we think of him as a little boy, in a way. We see pictures of him. As I said, he was born. He had parents. You know, he had to be delivered. I mean, all of that had to happen. But people were calling him, you know, little sir when he was young. And little great-minded one, you know, because people just knew. And that beautiful story of when, even when he was a very little boy, if he was playing with little girls, his mother would say, come back here, that's not for you. And he would know, even as a child. I mean, he himself said later that he knew. To me, that just means paying attention. To me, it means, where do we take ourselves where we don't belong? And where do we let ourselves, when do we get conscious or where do we stay unconscious? And, you know, these are just ideas for us to carry, because this is the purpose of his whole life, is to be able to show us the way. In every moment of his life becomes a lesson. Okay, so I'm going to do these salient characteristics. I'll read you a story or two about them, and then let's have a little discussion about each one. And I'm going to pick and choose the ones that we talk about. But the whole chapter's great, and I'll share with you that finding these characteristics, and then you could do one a week, going through all of our readings and looking for stories about his life or even Swamiji's that illustrate that. It's a wonderful exercise because each of these matters so much. So the first quality that Swamiji wrote in the chapter, he said, the outstanding trait that I observed was his complete absence of ego. When I looked into his eyes, it was like looking into infinity. And then, we read that story one Sunday every year where Debbie says to him something about his humility. And Master says back to him, how can there be humility when there's no consciousness of ego? You know, he just says, how could I be humble? What is there to be humble about? You have to have an ego to need to practice humility, which, of course, we probably, most of us do. I'll speak for myself. I do. So it's not that we can throw that. We're on our way to this quality of a complete absence of the ego. But we're on our way. So there's that wonderful story in... Swamiji tells it in The Path, but I think Master also tells it in the autobiography of the yogi when they were going to dedicate his school, Ranchi. And he was asking around, this is when he returned to India in 1935, who should I bring here? And everybody wanted him to bring this highly esteemed judge to preside at the opening and to give a talk. So Master went to meet the judge. Is this story familiar to anybody? Remember this? The man treated him abominably. He told him that he just thought he was arrogant, and he thought a lot of saints were arrogant, and he just said every mean thing he could say. And in the end of all of it, Master just listened, and he said, the judge said, India is overburdened with these worthless fellows. You know, there are people in India, and who hold that thought. We just came back from Israel, you know, where the ultra-Orthodox Jews are. They are men who will not work. They think they want to be studying the Talmud all the time. And there's a lot to say about that because they're not avatars. They're not all even saints. And so there's a lot of question in some of these countries about who really are the saints, who really are the people who we should be taking care of, feeding, supporting, learning from. So he says India is overburdened with these worthless fellows. He said this to Master. Master says at the end of all of it, thank you for your answer. He says, nevertheless, we shall be honored to have you preside at our event, should you care to grace us with your presence. That's what he said to him. And then they went back, and they were having the dedication of the school. Somebody else was standing up to speak, and the judge showed up. And the judge went up and said that this was a little hard for me, but he said he was testing Master, that he really wanted to see if this was a true Master or not. He said, I said every awful thing to him that I could think to say. And he said he remained calmly active and actively calm the whole time. The man didn't say that. But in Master's words, nothing threw him. Zero reactivity. It's an extraordinary quality. I mean, it was who he is. It wasn't a quality. But again, if we think of ourselves and how we might practice that or manifest that in our own lives. Anybody want to talk for a minute about it? Right.
I don't have anything to say, just like, I'm very hot.
You know, anybody have any way to make it, you're exactly right, of course, that's it, but how do we make it real? How can we bring that, you know, into an experience? I mean, how can we remind ourselves?
I was in a meeting, and this was the first time that I ever was going to do that, but I was about ready to walk out because I was just so irritated. And I was looking down at a paper in front of me, and I thought, and I'm in a room with like 12 people in there, and I thought, I'm just not understanding. You know, everyone here is just trying to find happiness in their own way, and I'm not understanding her way of communicating or her way of wanting to get things done. You know, we just have different points of view. And so I said, I just need to have an open heart. Mm-hmm. And just try to understand what she's trying to communicate and just be open.
It's wonderful. Did it work?
It did. It calmed me down.
Yes.
It was a lot of ups and downs. I called David afterwards. But it definitely calmed me down to not want to leave the room.
My experience with this, because that's great, I mean, that you were able to call on the teachings. When I was made manager of the church, it really came to me when I was asked to be manager that I had to, and along with that, if not soon after, I was invited to become one of the spiritual directors of Ananda Palo Alto. That meant a lot to me. I mean, really a lot. Now, many of you sitting in this room know also that I have not been able to practice it every minute. But I said to myself, you have a congregation here. You have to love every person in this congregation. Now, you think of everybody in this congregation. That was not necessarily an easy task. Really, I mean that. I mean, from a personality point of view. So then I had a way of saying, it's like you saying to yourself, every meeting that I go to, if I start getting riled up, I'm going to say to myself, that person's really wanting to find happiness. That person, if you set that goal ahead of time, every time you walk in, you really lose that reactivity. I think if we don't have it set ahead of time, we really run the risk of falling into old habits. And I know for myself, it is a practice. It's not a one practice, but it is a practice. When people come in and start telling me what I'm doing wrong and complaining at me, which happens with some degree of regularity, that the rule is that I am not allowed to react. But I have to really say to myself, listen to what they're saying and find out what's true here. Ask yourself, where's the truth in what they're saying? So it's a habit because you set a way of being that draws you closer because, you know, Swamiji or Master says, really, a saint is a sinner who never gave up. So in some lifetime, he too reacted. Now it would never even have dawned on him. But for us to begin to practice how we'll be ahead of the moment where we need to be in eventually leads us here. Anybody else?
I know that when I get upset, it's because I want you to be different than you are. So the active part for me is just to remind myself that it's okay. Whatever is happening is okay.
That's great.
I don't need to. It's sort of the practicing of the being in the moment.
Yeah.
And like when Master was with him on the other day, he said, you're not upset.
Well, I think that's a great, great reminder, though, that really, if we didn't want things to be different than how they are, we would never be upset. That's really the truth. If we were all resting in pure contentment, we would never be upset. So to that kind of a reminder is so beautiful, like, okay, I'm just going to say to myself, nothing needs to change right now. Nothing needs to be different. It's so helpful. It's particularly helpful with people we're close with, because it's amazing how often we can want them to be different than who they are. And it's
one more thing that, so the way I trick myself into remembering that is, I
trick myself, she said.
Is I remember there's nothing but God. There's nothing but God. Everything is God. And when I can think that, and then the person who's upsetting me on the other side, I say, that's just nasty. He's checking to see what I'm going to do. Like he's testing to see if I show up to you like this, what will you do? And then if I can say, oh, I got you, master. You know, nice try. Then how do you know? Yeah, that always works.
It's beautiful. The next one, Swamiji says, another trait that always amazed me was the deep, impersonal respect he gave everyone. And he says in the New Path at one point, so he says he was perfectly willing to have people who didn't agree with what he was saying, or he didn't agree with what they were saying, to allow them to have the last word. Just think of how hard that is in many moments. That is a real challenge. Just let somebody else, even when you don't agree, just to sit there. We've been practicing that in some of our meetings recently, I'll tell you, as we're going through the negotiation, you know, around. It's really an interesting thing to realize you don't have to add yet another sentence. But in the book, he uses a couple of examples. One is how he was with Gandhi. You remember the example where he said to Gandhi, what would you do if somebody walked into a room or a crowd of people and they were going to shoot everybody? And Gandhi said, I'd make sure they shoot me first. And you know, when you think of it, it makes no sense. It really makes no sense. You know, and yet Master didn't say a word. And there's another example that Swamiji talks about, in the New Path, where he was with Ramana Maharshi, who was also speaking about this difference, really, or speaking to the difference between what an avatar does when an avatar comes to raise the consciousness of the whole world, or what saints do when they're working more individually with people. And Master said to Ramana Maharshi, well, do you think that you can really sort of just aim to raise the consciousness of the whole world? And Ramana Maharshi said, absolutely not. You have to work one soul at a time. It's all a question of changing each individual soul. And Master went on to say, in his ashram, it was written up as if he kind of got the final word with Master, as if the newsletter held Master up in not a very positive light. But Master never said a word. He just let the whole thing go. I never thought about, in the same way, how respectful it is to just let somebody say what they need to say and be done. It's not just that we're learning and we're getting control of ourselves. It is an extraordinary act of respect to just let that happen. And I think it comes on the heels of what you're talking about, Eloisa. This amazing feeling that things should be different, or that we can always make it better. It can be very subtle. For me, it's not so subtle. I mean, I watch myself. I do it a lot. But it can be more subtle, ways that we think we're just going to rearrange things and make it better. So it just, I could really feel why Master called that deep, impersonal respect he gave everyone. because it felt that way the more I read about it. And particularly with great saints like Ramana Maharshi and Mahatma Gandhi, to let them be, to let them feel, and particularly in the eyes of their own disciples and people who were around, to let it just go that way. So, what does that bring up for anybody, or examples or places? I want us to talk about it at our level, because I think it's how we can truly interiorize these lessons. It's one thing for us to look at this avatar and say, of course he was this. He was beyond ego. That's by definition what an avatar is. But he came to show us how to do it. So I think it's important to just share everyday stories about developing these qualities for ourselves.
I found reading in Divine Friendship that was the quality I respected most from Swamiji, was his respect for every single person that he talked to, from 19 whatever to 2000 whatever.
Yeah.
Every single letter, even if he wasn't happy, it was just the utmost respect for that human being. I don't even think it was for that person particularly. It was just your being as well. And that's what he respected. Every letter, I was just time after time.
Yeah.
Like, wow.
That's a very good point. Even because for those of you who don't know, we have these book study meetings on Monday nights. That people join after a certain period of time here. It's not important. If anybody's interested, you can ask me about it. But we just finished studying a book of letters that Swamiji wrote literally over decades in response to people's letters or concerns. And we studied them letter by letter. Now, I've read that book before. I imagine others have. It's very different. Really studying them and coming into a room and wanting to talk about them. Excuse me. You go so much deeper with it, and you get in this point that David's making, which I felt too, because in many of these letters, not all of them, but in many of them, he wasn't even just correcting people. He was saying, sometimes this is a quality in you that's in your way. It's a very challenging quality, or you really misbehaved. I mean, he didn't always. Many of the letters were, you know, saying to people, wow, great, thank you so much. I mean, there were everything from love letters to very difficult letters to write. But no matter what he had to say to people, that's what David was saying, even if he wasn't so happy, meaning, even if he was communicating a lesson that he knew would be challenging to that person, it was always done, I agree with you, every letter, a very good point, with such deep respect. It's worth reading it, because it's a great lesson on how to, even how to communicate honestly and respectfully. I understand why Arjuna threw that darn arrow down on the ground. I want to throw my own bow and arrow down on the ground. I don't want to fight with these people. I love these people. These are the people I've lived with, served with, taught around the world with, shared more meals than I can think of with. They're my brothers and my sisters. It's very complicated to live with. Forget the complete absence of ego. Even deep impersonal respect. I mean it. We have to keep these as our goals. You know, that's why, I mean, in a way, that scene with my patient today, which reflecting on it is just amazing me. I probably would have never thought of it again. But that really happened. And that's important. Somebody said to her, you want to leave your goal down here? That's where you'll be. You want to bring your goal up here? Here and decide, of course I can go to medical school. Of course I can. It's very complicated, but we're all on our way, and we're all heading there. But this is why we get together for nights like tonight, and I really mean this, and talk about these characteristics of a master, and ask ourselves, and keep bringing ourselves back. And then, honestly, as we're driving in the car to those meetings, just keep saying to each other, you know, remember who these people are that we're meeting with. Remember that how we behave, how we hold them, the words that come out of our mouth, our mouths, you know, the feelings that we're holding in our hearts, that's what our spiritual path is about. That at the end of all of this, and I've said this and I've written it in so many letters, and every letter that's going out has been a conglomerate of all of us writing it, and we just keep saying, and I keep saying, I want to be able to look in the mirror at the end of what? The community issue, a day in, at the church, an evening with my partner, this life, to look in a mirror and say, I did the very best I can to see you and everyone in every moment, Master. Really, that's what we have to do. So as long as we can do that and come back, was I my best today? That was really great. You know, being able to stop yourself of not walking out of a meeting, saying, wait a minute, this person's looking for happiness as much as I am, or everybody's master that I'm looking at, or practicing being calmly active and actively calm, having that constantly. You know, when I said before, in fact, I'm going to play it again in a couple minutes, just to listen to this poem and really hear the words again, and let's bring Master's vibration back, because if every one of us listened to it every day, that's what we're doing. We're on our way towards perfectly reuniting our soul with Master's soul. So every conversation like that, instead of, but let me show you, and don't you see, and there are facts here that matter, and, you know, we need to do some of that. But it's great that you did, I'm serious, that you didn't, and that you could. It's so easy to get emotional about this stuff. You know, we're not playing, these are not little easy games. I mean, if we, giving up the community means not having a home in the most expensive area here, not being able to live with our friends, gurubais, brothers, sisters, not being able to walk out and be in front of that those extraordinary shrines to the master, not being able to have a dinner available every night that's been made with high vibration. You know, when you get upset, you just walk two doors over. You say to somebody, help me out of this. I'm about to get angry, or I'm struggling with this or struggling with that. You know, how many times I've walked in to one of my friends' homes in that community. So, if we have to leave the community, we have to leave and say to ourselves, of course we'll be fine. We'll be absolutely fine. There's no doubt about it. But when you're trying to examine how should we move, you know, what is it that happened on that battlefield? You know, really to ask ourselves that question. There's a lot at stake. And boy, does the ego like to grab a hold of that. But it's true. There is a lot at stake. And we'll be fine no matter what. That's also true.
So then you end everything with your comment. But if I can, when I'm there, and it happens mostly with my husband, but when I'm there, I tell myself, I don't know everything. You know, sort of like, how many times have I been surprised in the silence after I shut up, and then there's a silence, and then my husband comes back with a really wise comment. yeah. that I was not expecting. And so I just tell myself, you know, life or this idea is like a diamond with many facets. And I don't see all the facets. And so if I can shut up and if I can go a little bit higher, then I can open it up to being able to see more of the possibilities.
Yeah. Very good. And that's really true. One of the lines in one of my letters recently in this scenario that's been consuming my life was, how could it be that all of these people who I love have loved and respected as much as I've loved and respected them? Could it be that I could be so right and they could only be so wrong? Doesn't make sense. It really doesn't. And I love what you said too about sitting in the silence, actually giving Jose room to say something. Then you go, wow, he actually also had something wise to say. Very good. Swamiji says, he understood others from within themselves and not as most people do from the outside, which is really actually an extraordinary follow-up. I didn't realize it's what you're just saying, Eloisa, about listening, knowing, and listening, but listening also with our hearts. He talks here about a disciple that was there who was he called him salty. Swamiji called him rather salty. Doesn't really matter, but he conveyed in what he wrote in here the idea that most people found him very hard to be near. But he said Master always embraced him and after even particularly difficult moments with him, would embrace him with a loving laugh. But he goes on in the path. I'll read this to you. Oh, I'll just tell you. He's talking about the story in the path. He said, why was Master able to come? And, I mean, Master walked into this culture in the 1920s and very quickly found himself speaking to audiences of 5,000 people. I mean, to go into Carnegie Music Hall and keep people chanting, Oh God Beautiful. No, it wasn't. It was, Oh God Beautiful? For an hour and a half. I mean, think of it. And people said they had ecstatic experiences there. He touched so many people individually. Then Swamiji tells that very beautiful story about a man who found Master later in life, but said to him, I saw you very early on in a talk in Boston, and I was so touched. And he said, I've always wondered what happened to you. And he told Master, he said, when I was sitting in that hall, he said, there were thousands of people. He said, but I felt that you looked at me and you were speaking to me. And Master said to him, I remember. I mean, just like that, years and years later. You know, to really be with somebody so that you can know them right in that moment and what they need and what they need. And people feel seen and heard and loved. That doesn't happen to most of us very often in life. People are very quick to respond and not ask the next question. And I don't mean so much in a class, but in a one-on-one or in a group situation, how many times do we feel really heard by somebody? It's a beautiful experience. It helps us feel solid and meaningful, and as if we have something to bring to the world, and it helps us become our best. And yet, it really doesn't happen all that often. He said, that guy, Mr. Rogers, he said it was strange too. That huge hall was completely packed. Yet through your entire lecture, you kept your eyes fixed on me. And that's when Master said, I remember. Swamiji says with a quiet smile. Swamiji, and you know, everybody talks about how often questions that they have would be answered, or they felt such a personal connection with Master and with Swamiji. Somebody really just tuning in. How can we remember to really feel the person that we're with and not just come with so much to share already that we don't have an experience of them? Because that becomes a masterful quality, a masterful trait, to listen with our heart.
I think for me, most of you know this, but most of my day at work is spent mediating with students who are fighting their high schoolers. And this is a big lesson that I learned, is to create the space. And there are two things. One, I make the office very sattvic. Swami's music is always playing because they come in with really big egos, and so you have to create an energy that's bigger than that space of mostly anger. They're usually coming in angry for one reason or another. But I've been in this position. I've lasted longer than anyone else who's done this position, and it's because I think what I've learned is to honor the student and to honor whatever is going on for him or her. There's no expectations in the room. And honoring doesn't just mean trying to solve the problem. It means meeting them where they are. So if anger is as high as they can go, then that's where we stay and we sit in it, the ultimate goal being empathy. But just to really sit in that space and listen, and much like your experience with your patient today, it's never about what they're coming in to talk about. But for a lot of them, I think it's the only time in the day that they actually have somebody who is patient enough to sit with them.
I think for all of us, because you're there, you're with your students. You're doing it brilliantly. And like you said, not only have you lasted longer, but I'm sure if we spoke to people, they would say, wow, she's amazing. I'm sure of it. And I get to do it in medicine. It's so inherently not personal. There's not a lot at stake for us. But it then becomes an example of how to be when there is a lot at stake. Like to really be listening to each patient, what is trying to happen here, one by one by one, or each student. And then to say, what just went on throughout this day that was so beautiful that I could bring into life where it matters more? Because that's exactly what it is. I mean, there's room to listen. You feel somebody. I love listening to, I don't ever get to hear your stories, but just, isn't that beautiful? She has an office, and these teenagers are coming in ready to tear each other apart, and she has Swamiji's music playing. Really? Anybody else about this?
Can you tell the story again of your Swami's speech experience? Because I don't really know what you mean by you feel master. Because I love that story.
Everybody's heard it so often. I'll tell a brief version of it, though. Because it's not... It's a beautiful story, mostly because it tells us how much they love us, to know in that scheme that I was talking about, like from Babaji to Lahiri to Sri Yukteswar to Master to Swamiji to us, that we've all been touched in these ways. So I think we ought to end this evening by doing two things. Let's listen to the poem again. Well, let's just do that. I do have the recording of Master singing, Oh God, Beautiful. So I thought we were going to chant it, but somehow the evening just went quickly. I thought for me it went quickly. Anyway, but let's just listen to him do this, say this again. For those of you who weren't here yet, I was talking about, were you here when we listened? Yeah, it's very different listening to the poem than it is listening to anybody sing it. Sai Ganesh usually sings it. He says God, Christ, Guru, and it's a poem he wrote, but we sing it as God, God, God. But when you're into the music, it takes you someplace else. And it's very powerful to sing to do this. So let's So let's all just take a moment and let's get ourselves sitting up straight and keep our eyes closed and really see if we can absorb. We'll hear the words differently, but absorb the vibration of Master's voice. Thank you all. I feel way better than I did an hour and a half ago. I really do. You gotta love Master.